We want to begin by introducing your MC for the evening, Kobe Jewelry.
This is going to be a wonderful event. Everyone in here is committed and dedicated to the cause of uplifting oppressed people. This dinner has been happening for 46 years. I'm 23 years old, right? So this event has been happening for twice as long as I've been alive. And the person I'm going to introduce to you now, I've had a lot of conversations with him, and there is so much history that comes through in just a random everyday conversation on a Tuesday. And there is so much history in this room. There's so many people who have put decades of their lives into lifting up oppressed people, and we just want to honor that today. So the person that I'm going to introduce to you right now is Frank Chapman. He is a veteran organizer. He is a leader in our organization and in Chicago. He is one of the best people I've ever met in my life.
Thank you for your kind words. I just want to say a couple of things about our organization, why we're here, why we do what we do, and where we're at with our current struggle in terms of CPAC. You know, it's hard to get people to understand even our name, like National Alliance Against Racism and Political Repression. When I, get interns oriented into our work, we have a lot of interns, young students who work with us, I ask them, do you know the difference between oppression and repression? And 90% of them are honest, and they say no, they don't know, you know. We're not the National Alliance Against Racist and Political Oppression, but repression. And that's a very important thing to point out, because what repression does is there to keep us oppressed. Oppressed people automatically rise up and fight against their oppressors. That's been going on for thousands of years. And so have jails, and so have prisons, and so have armies, and so have police. They're there to put us down. They're there to hold us in place. That's their role. And so Frederick Douglass once said, if I was an ox, you could put the yoke on me and I just walk with the yoke. But I'm a human being, so you can't just put the yoke on me. What you have to do, you have to put chains on me. You know, you have to hire people to watch over me. You have to have police and militia and patrols and whatnot to make sure that I don't get off the plantation. That's what repression is about. That's repression. Repression is about stopping our movement from moving. That's what it's about. People in the Philippines can tell you what it's about. People in Palestine can tell you what it's about, because it goes on every day of their lives. And those of us who are black and Latino in the United States can also tell you what it's about. That's why our organization was founded. It was founded to fight this repression. Now, the history is too rich and too long. It's, 46 years. And so I don't have time to go into all of that. So let me just say that one of the things that we're facing here in Chicago is very serious. In this city, like hundreds of other cities throughout the country, we are over-patrolled by the police and under-protected. Over-patrolled and under-protected. So why is that? I asked people, I said, do you see a great mass movement on the south side of Chicago or the west side of Chicago for housing? Do you see a great mass movement for employment to get people jobs, particularly our young people who are 50% unemployed? Do you see a great mass movement to stop these prisons from treating our people with such cruelty? No, you don't. And the reason why you don't is because of repression. That's what the police are there for. Now, if you think that they're there to protect our community, you're wrong. 80% of the homicides committed on the south side of Chicago and on the west side of Chicago are unsolved. unsolved. And a lot of those people, 542 of them in fact, that are in jail as a result of torture and whatnot, were sent there by torture to get false confessions. So it's not about protecting us. It's about repressing us. And the reason why they are repressing us is because they know the conditions under which we live are rebellious conditions. They're conditions that naturally give rise to rebellion. And so that's why Mayor Lightfoot said, no, I'm not going to say no one cop academy, no one $96 million. I'm going to say we need a lot of cop academies. Okay? That's why she said that. Because she is tying into that program. And that program is about keeping us from doing the things that we need to do as a people to get the things that we deserve to have. The National Alliance Against Race and Political Repression, well, that's not what we are right now. Right now, we're the Chicago Alliance Against Race and Political Repression. Our responsibility, our duty, and our commitment is to defend our movement, is to stop police crimes, to give our people the organizing space that they need in order to fight the injustices that we face on a daily basis. That's what we're here for. And we're going to make that happen. We're going to get community control of the police in this city. And why are we going to get it? We're going to get it because we're not going to stop fighting until we get it. That's why we're going to get it. Don't tell me we can't do it. Yes, we can. Because those in power are not greater than the power of the people. So we can get this done. We can get this done. So we want you to join us tonight and to join us, period, in what's going to be a long and noble struggle. I'm not going to delude you. I wouldn't delude you, Jeanette Taylor. I'm not going to delude you. I'm not going to tell you it's going to be a short struggle, that we're going to arrive there next week. Somebody told me that a long time ago. That was like 40 years ago. It's a protracted struggle. It's a long struggle. But it's one that we are destined to win, because we as a people are never going to surrender to being enslaved, to being in bondage. Thank you.
Yeah, so the next people that I'm going to introduce, they know a lot about struggle. They know a lot about hardship. And if you've never been to an Anakbayan Chicago event, you should go, because these are some of the most energetic and dedicated people that you will ever meet.
My name is Maya. I am the former chairperson of Anakbayan Chicago.
My name is Love. I'm the former vice chair.
I'm Anthony. I'm also the former vice chair.
So we actually all came from the Youth and Student National Democratic Movement for Liberation in the Philippines. We've since been doing a lot of other organizing work in the Filipino community, but regardless of what organization we're with, we are still wholeheartedly in solidarity with the Chicago Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression and fighting for Black liberation. And the reason that, you know, we need to stand in solidarity with one another is because we're fighting the same oppressors, right? Every day that a Black person is targeted in this country, every day that a person is repressed and tortured and arrested in this country, it's the same thing that's happening to Filipinos across the Philippines, and even here, right? We're also facing deportations here. And so, you know, we see the same violence, the same people who are causing this bloodshed across the Philippines. Right now, it's actually 30,000 people who have been killed by the government within the past 3 years. And so we have to connect our struggles and fight for liberation side by side together, because every blow against this dictatorship, every blow against these oppressors is one that's a victory for all of us. And so we're going to sing a song for you right now. This is a song basically about many of the people who have been killed in the war on drugs in the Philippines. Many of them are youth. One in particular that we're talking about is Kian Lloyd de los Santos, who is a 17-year-old boy who was killed by the police. They basically gave him a gun, told him to run in the opposite direction, and then shot him in the back. And he said that, like, why are you targeting me? Like, I'm just trying to study. Like, I want to go study and get ready for school for the next day. And so it's heavy, but at the same time, we know that the only way that we'll stop this violence is by organizing and coming together as a community to fight back.
For every child killed, for every mother mourning, for every Quien de los Santos, for every life taken too soon, we raise our fists for you, we march these streets for you. For each one of us they take, 1,000 more will rise anew.
My heart is a burning city, robbed by battle lines and body counts, by aerial bombs and the forced migration of migrant mothers who've only returned home to bury the children they left to feed Quien Loy de los Santos. Was 17 years old when the Philippine National Police put a gun in his hand and told him to run. Carl Angelo Arnaiz was 19 years old when they shot him handcuffed. And kneeling, Ronaldo de Guzman was only 14 when they stabbed him 30 times for just being a witness. My heart is a raging fire for the names that keep coming, for the names I can't remember, for the names I won't forget.
For every child killed, for every mother mourning, for every Quien de los Santos, for every life taken too soon, we raise our fists for you, we march these streets for you. For each one of us they take, 1,000 more will rise anew.
And I am sitting in front of relatives, sweating away their humanity, wiping away the blood, saying, but that's what you get when you don't listen to the cops, or, well, all this power to the people might get me killed, and I get that. But how worthless must his last breath be to you? Balancing is not just an act anymore when you're hiding behind an imported culture, because this is not what our history has taught us. No, not ours, because our culture has been rich with resistance for the past 500 years, from Lapu-Lapu to Gabriela Silang to the current people's movement. The Filipino masses have always fought back. Even the land is angry. Mount Mayon erupts for the mountains that have collapsed. The Asia-Pacific Rim shakes for the dried rivers and poisoned waters. My heart is a revolution, bringing fire and brimstone, clenched fists and bolos against the corrupt politicians and their foreign puppet masters whose greed fuels this bloodshed.
For every child killed, for every mother mourning, for every Quien de los Santos, for every life taken too soon, we raise our fists for you, we march these streets for you. We'll oust the U.S. and their empire and Duterte too.
The movement that has brought dictators down, that will bring a dictator down, that is made of not only words but action. Have you forgotten your pain and the way it hungers for justice? Have you forgotten your anger and the pulse it leaves beneath your chest? Have you forgotten their names? Quien Loy de los Santos, 17 years old. Carl Angelo Arnaiz, 19 years old. Ronaldo de Guzman, 14 years old. There are too many names I can't remember. There are too many names I won't forget. There are too many migrant mothers coming back home to body bags. And I am sitting in front of relatives, sweating away their humanity, wiping away the blood. Have you forgotten your heart?
Thank you.
Okay, that was amazing. Before we move on to the awards, I want to recognize a couple of people in the audience today. From SEIU Local 73, we have the President, Diane Palmer, and we also have the Executive Vice President, Jeffrey Howard. Yeah, we appreciate everything that you do for this organization, for working people in Chicago. Yeah, so I want to welcome Willie Williamson to the stage again to present awards to to our recipients for this Human Rights Awards dinner. I also welcome Joe Osbaker and Sarah Simmons to the stage to present the other awards.
Good evening again. It's very important that we continue to support our youth. That is the future. Yesterday was an amazing day for you. Young climate change activists came out. In this city, as was mentioned by Brother Frank, there is some very, very harsh realities taking place here. One being in the form of an academy for police training. And that's coming with a price tag of $95 million. Also, we have to look at that and understand that there are people here struggling. And as a former school teacher, I would not hesitate to say that the Chicago Teachers Union is on the verge of carrying out another strike. Right here in this city where we have $95 million being proposed for a cop academy. And that is really hard to really think about. Housing is a problem here. Schools are a problem. Policing is a problem. Young people on the West Side have taken it upon themselves to fight this. And they have been doing some amazing work in fighting to make our communities safe and help to end gun violence by investing those $95 million in job training, education, after-school programs, mental health services, instead of a new police facility. That would go a long ways in promoting the democracy and the democratic process that our youth deserve to see happening. We do not need any more police academies. On behalf of the Chicago Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression, I would like to invite the young people from No Cop Academy to the stage. In recognition of your leadership in the struggle to secure justice and human rights, the Chicago Alliance present this award to No Cop Academy. A lot of thought goes into the process of selecting honorees. This next honoree I met a few years ago, and if you have not read the short bio of her work, here is a brief list of some of the things that she has been working on. The rights of immigrants, the rights of migrants, asylum seekers, economic rights, and the prohibition against torture. Our next awardee graduated from Boeing High School. She has degrees from the U of C and the University of Michigan. Dr. Susan Gesch. This award also is in recognition of your leadership in the struggle to secure justice and human rights. The Chicago Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression proudly presents this award to Dr. Susan Gesch.
Thank you. I want to just add a couple of notes about formative influences in my life, because I think as a teacher, it's important for me to remember what moved me and understand the moments that help inspire the activism of the young people of No Cop Academy from remembering what I got going with when I was in my 20s. I went to Chicago Public Schools, and then I went to the University of Chicago on a scholarship from the Chicago Teachers Union because my mother was a member of the founding generation of the CTU, and I'm proud to support the CTU in their struggles today. When I went to University of Chicago, something that happened in the fall of my second year in the college was December 4th, 1969, the assassination of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark on the west side of Chicago by Chicago Police deputized by Cook County State's Attorney Ed Hanrahan, and the revelations of what happened on that in that case, and the work that the lawyers did and the work that the community did to try to bring the truth to light when we had major media outlets in the city that were buying the story given out by the police that it was a shootout and that there was a whole other narrative that had to be told. And thanks to the courage of the people who worked on that, both from the West Side community, the Black Panther Party, the lawyers of the People's Law Office, whose 50th anniversary we celebrated last week, an important era of understanding across Chicago what lies were capable of being sustained by the Chicago Police Department is something that was a formative experience for me. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail, but I also learned a lot about lawyering when I got to law school and met the National Lawyers Guild lawyers in the city of Detroit and watched their relationship with the Attica brothers, who were on trial in Buffalo, New York during that mid-70s period for the prison rebellion they had led in Attica. When I came back to Chicago in 1980, because I had sort of learned how to speak Spanish someplace between college and law school, I began working here with immigrant activists such as Carlos Arango, the late Rudy Lozano, and one of the paralegals right out of UIC in the office that I worked in when I moved back was now our Congressman Chuy Garcia. So understanding that what it meant to be a lawyer was not helping our less fortunate brothers and sisters, but more an understanding of working in solidarity is something that I've tried to bring to our students at the University of Chicago, where I've been directing the Center for Human Rights for almost 20 years. It's a tremendous amount of pride to me to see people like Victoria Alvarez, who's working as the communications director at Local 73 SEIU, and the places that the students who've come through our program have gone. So it's, you know, pass it on, carry it forward, and getting this award from an organization that has had such a history and has such a spectacular honor roll of honorees. I was awed reading the program, the list of local and national figures who have spoken before this group and thanked you for the same award that I'm getting tonight. So thank you very much, and onward.
It's my honor to introduce our next awardee. So I'm Joe Osbaker, by the way. I'm on the steering committee of the Alliance, and I've been there for 5 years now. Hatem Abudeya is among my closest comrades. I've been butchering Arabic for many years, but I'll teach you the word for comrade in Arabic is Rafiq. Rafiq. So Hatem is also one of those organizers that shuns the spotlight. But 9 years ago, actually 9 years ago in 3 days, his home and my home were raided by the FBI in what is the largest campaign of political repression against a social movement since the days of COINTELPRO. Before the witch hunt was over, 23 of us were subpoenaed. Anti-war activists and Palestinian activists, mostly here in Chicago, were subpoenaed to a federal grand jury investigating us on, basically trumped-up charges that we were aiding terrorists in Palestine and Colombia, which basically means opposing U.S. foreign policy. And 3 years later, a beloved community activist, Rasmia Oda, from the Palestinian movement here, was raided and arrested by the Department of Homeland Security and was basically tied to our case. And it was my task in the summer of 2014 to go to a national conference on police crimes being held by the Alliance, where I met Frank Chapman, and I asked him, I had the gall, because this is what the movement requires us to do, to ask you to introduce me to Angela Davis so I could ask her to speak up on behalf of Rasmia, which, of course, she did. And in the months that followed that, Frank and I went back and forth to the hearings and eventually the trial of Rasmia. And then in the course of that, Frank convinced us in the Committee to Stop FBI Repression and the Arab American Action Network to join the Alliance. And here we are 5 years later, because it really is one struggle against racist and political repression. And so telling that story by way of just introducing to you my dear friend and Rafiq Hatem Abadea to receive the 2019 Charlene Mitchell Human Rights Award in recognition of your leadership in the struggle to secure justice and human rights.
I want to thank first Willie Williamson and the other wonderful members of the tonight's program committee for this honor. Every year's awardees, as Susan mentioned, and speakers list is pretty impressive, but tonight's is extra special, really. Keynote speaker Timothy Johnson, Alderwoman Jeanette Taylor, the No Cop Academy, of course, and human rights attorney and my friend Susan Zesch. Please give them all another round of applause, please. And it's also a very special night, because every night with the Alliance and my friend Frank Chapman is a special night. And because we are celebrating the incredible, groundbreaking work of the Alliance. Now, there are some great campaigns in this city. A number of them are represented in the room tonight. No Cop Academy, of course, the Obama Center Community Benefits Agreement Campaign, the Chicago Teachers Union Labor Struggle for Better Wages and Social Struggle for Better Neighborhoods and Schools, and all of them also address black liberation in one way or another. But in my organization and community's estimation, the CPAC campaign is the essence of black liberation and self-determination in this city and country. Winning community control of the police in a massive city with a massive police force like Chicago would be such an important victory that it would make it possible in dozens of other cities, and would change the material relationship between the black community and government like no other piece of legislation anywhere. I don't think the Alliance considers Lightfoot a people's mayor, but now we finally have alder people like Jeanette Taylor and Carlos Rosa and Rosana Rodriguez Sanchez in the City Council who truly represent us. So CPAC is not only powerful, but winnable. And it's going to need your money tonight to win. And lastly, I am receiving this award tonight on behalf of my organizations, the Arab American Action Network and the United States Palestinian Community Network, and the Arab, thank you, and the Arab communities that they represent. We are receiving this award because the Alliance recognizes that Palestinian and Arab communities' equality and liberation are directly bound to the equality and liberation of black people, Native Americans, Chicanos, women, LGBTQ people, immigrants, workers, and all poor people in the United States. The analysis is simple. The oppressors of the Palestinians are not only the Israelis, but also the reactionary Arab regimes, and especially U.S. imperialism. So our people all over the world have different responsibilities. The resistance in Palestine is different than it is here. Here, in the belly of the beast, we must organize at the grassroots to weaken the empire. And the struggle today that most weakens the empire is the struggle for black liberation. The main demand in the black community is for law enforcement to stop killing black people. So we join the Alliance to fight for CPAC, a demand that was first articulated by the Black Panthers way back in the 70s. In Chicago, and this is where we rise up the work of the Alliance. In Chicago, for the first time ever, a white cop on duty was convicted of murder for killing a black person. Teenager Laquan McDonald, presente. The leading force making certain that there was popular support for the conviction was the Chicago Alliance. And Palestinians and Arabs were in the street with you all in force. The material reality is that black liberation in the U.S., along with the victories of workers' struggles here against their bosses, would lead to the social transformation in this country that is needed to liberate people, including Palestinians and Arabs, all over the world from U.S. domination. And this is why we always state, loudly and clearly, black liberation will lead to liberation for all. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. I'm Sarah Simmons, and it is my great joy to introduce our next Human Rights Award recipient. I met Jeanette first about 6 years ago, and we were working on education justice issues, and I recognized in her a freedom fighter who did not hold back. She went with a group of parents by bus to Washington, D.C., with other teachers and students from the Kenwood Oakland Community Organization. They took their case to the top. They went to then Secretary of Education Arne Duncan, and they told him simply, closing schools is not a budget issue. It is a civil rights issue, and it is a human rights issue. It's a moral issue. And I also heard her tell our then mayor that these are our streets and our schools, and Rahm, you work for us. Jeanette took the lead in a 30-day hunger strike. Again, parents who gathered around to keep Dyett High School open. They did not eat for 30 days. These people walked the walk. And they won. Dyett is open. Finally, I want to say, while other aldermen and wannabe aldermen were saying, GAPA, CPAC, we need to do something, Jeanette made CPAC front and center of her campaign. So Jeanette, come on up and keep on fighting.
Thank you all. I am honored to be here tonight, and I appreciate the Alliance honoring me, but I don't feel like I've done anything special. It's our duty to stand up and fight for each other, and so that's an honor for me to be able to do. I am sitting in this space because of the Alliance, and so I'm always indebted to the brothers and sisters who got up every morning to come out and push me when I didn't want to do it. And so I'm in this space because of you, and I thank you for that. I'm in a church, so I'm going to watch what I say. But quite often I get asked, how was the job? How was the job? I had a gentleman, I just told him, and I see him standing in front of me. He said, how's the job going? I said, I can't tell you inside the church. I'll tell you outside. But what I will say is, I don't understand how we can't fight for the many. It's a very easy job, and it's just a matter of us standing up and doing what's right. For folks who make $120,000 a year and get a pension for the rest of your life, you should be able to represent the people who got you in the office. And so I'm forever grateful, and I thank you all.
Now, a lot of y'all in this room are organizers, and y'all have been organizing for a lot longer than I have. So I don't have to tell you how hard it is and how little gratification you get on the day-to-day basis, right? A part of that is that this is a fundraiser. We do need funds from y'all. We do need support from y'all to keep the struggle going. In that spirit, I'd like to welcome up Mildred Williamson to give a special appeal.
Good evening, everybody.
Good evening.
Thanks to all of the awardees. You are deserving. Let's give them another round of applause. So the Alliance is 46 years old, but I cannot think of a single moment in time where we didn't need an anti-racist organization. Certainly there is a need right now. It's an organization that connects the dots. There is a connection between mass incarceration and mass deportation. There is a connection to the persecution of people all over the world by this government that also oppresses us here in this country. There is a connection to the whole issue of over-policing and under-protected, as Brother Frank talked about, and the dismantlement or the attempt to dismantle public education. And frankly, the main thing that has stood in the way of that full dismantlement is the Teachers Union of Chicago, but teachers unions and even teachers who don't have a union around the country who are fighting against this along with parents and students themselves. And I just want to call your attention to one of the many reasons why we still need an anti-racist organization is the recent revelations around several celebrities, including Felicity Huffman, I think that's her name, who had a $30,000 fine and 14 days in prison and some community service for basically lying and bribing to get her daughter in the school of her choice. Meanwhile, there's LaTanya McDowell, who has to serve 5 years in prison, who was homeless trying to get her child in an elementary school that might provide an education. So again, racism is living with us, and we need full-time, 24/7 activity to fight it back. And I just want to acknowledge that there is a lot of work in preparation for a refounding of the National Alliance Against Racism and Political Repression that will happen here in November. There are calls for that conference to do that, and they're out here on the table. You should take them. I understand we are in the 21st century and we can register online for that conference. So I am the one standing between you and our major speaker and finally completing our program. And that can be brief, especially if you all will cooperate. So everything we've been talking about, everything that we're trying to do, all anti-racist activity needs money. All right. One last thing. I'm thrilled that it was mentioned about we had our first ever in history police officer to go to actually be sentenced and go to prison for murder, which is what happened with Laquan McDonald. We have a long way to go. Let's not forget about Rakia Boyd and many others for whom their justice has not yet been served. Thank you all.
Now I'm going to introduce the keynote speaker, Timothy V. Johnson.
I actually never thought I'd be speaking from a pulpit anywhere. If my mother was still alive, I'm sure she'd be very pleased. As some of you know, I used to live in Chicago. I was here from between 79 and 85. And if some of you are old enough, you remember that encompasses the years of Harold Washington's first campaign. And I think, as I think most people who are involved in that campaign, is an experience that kind of stays with you for the rest of your life for a lot of reasons. One reason, it was a living example of what some call an all-people's front would look like and what it could do if it was energized. And it's good to come back later and see that Chicago city politics have changed with five or six progressive councilmen that are in office. Is something if Harold Washington's first tenure in the office had had people like that in the city council with him, I think it would be a much different city. Also, I'd like to thank the Alliance for inviting me here, and also to give credit to some of the people that kept the Alliance going. As you know, the Alliance was once a national organization, and it kind of shrunk to, I think, maybe a branch in Kentucky and branch in Chicago. And there are people like, well, some of the people I know of, I'm sure there are more, like Ted Pearson and Willie Williamson, Frank Chapman, and the late Josephine Wyatt are some of the people that kind of kept this thing going, that allows it to achieve some of the victories that they've achieved, and more importantly, kept it going so that it could set the stage for the refoundation of a national alliance against racism and political oppression. And I think that's something that is welcome news to the progressive community, the broad left, the African-American community, and all people that are engaged in the struggle for police accountability and against police violence. I'm not trying to be brief. But I'm just going to kind of tell you what briefly I want to address so that you'll know where I am in this, rather than sometimes it seems like the person's going to go on forever and you can never tell when he's getting close to the end. So I want to start by just making a few comments about history and the historical process, some comments about the history of slavery and capitalism, something about police violence, and then also about the African-American freedom struggle. You know, one of Dr. King's most quoted lines is when he said that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. And that kind of sense that humanity, society, is in a direction that bends towards justice in the long run, not away from justice, is something that's important and important to remember. The initial quote, it wasn't Dr. King's quote, but he kind of boiled that down from a longer quote from a 19th century abolitionist. But then that kind of notion of the forward progress of history is something that's deeply embedded in Western philosophy. Most importantly, in the philosophy of Hegel, who was a German philosopher, who had this kind of notion that the struggle in history was a struggle between the relationship between being and knowing, and the structure, the fight between being and knowing eventually leads to something he called the absolute idea, which is way more abstract than me or most people can think of. But it was important in terms of kind of reifying this idea that history bends towards progress, not towards regress. Karl Marx took that concept of a directional history, instead of looking at it through ideas, which was Hegel's line, looked at it through material progress of society, and kind of buttressed it by the knowledge that ultimately what people naturally want to do is improve their lives, improve their standard of living. And that motion kind of drives historical direction. As opposed to looking at it as the battle of ideas, Marx looked at it by looking at societies and how they were organized, how basically people organized to reproduce themselves, feed themselves, house themselves, clothe themselves. And that once people got beyond a subsistence level through the development of tools and other kinds of things, there began to develop cleavages within societies, which what he called classes. So that under feudalism, you have serfs and you have the feudal lords. And society goes through those kinds of processes. And that in the current time, as the feudal lords are overthrown, they're displaced by people who, in many cases, came from the lower classes. And by owning businesses and engaging in trade, created another class, which he called the bourgeoisie, that then continued to develop economy in their interest and thereby created another class of people who work for a living and who work for them. Now, that's just to kind of say for the backdrop of what I wanted to address. I don't know how many of you have been keeping up with it, but a couple of months ago, the New York Times introduced something called the 1619 Project. And the 1619 Project is an attempt to center the African-American experience within the context of the broader American national narrative. In the U.S. national narrative that's taught in schools and all of that, for years, the role of African Americans simply wasn't discussed at all. And then after the freedom movement of the 60s, it began to be introduced into the curriculum, but was kind of introduced as a side issue, as something that wasn't particularly germane or influential to the direction of the country. And that, among other things, is not a normal way to look at history. And by example, about 20 years ago, I was studying the experience of African descended people in Venezuela. And in reading things, I had noticed that there was a slave revolt that took place in the city of Coro, which is on the Caribbean coast of Venezuela. And it was a fellow named Jose Chirinos, was an Afro-descended Venezuelan who was born a slave. Some kind of way he was able to gain his freedom. and started engaging in trade. And through the Caribbean, he was going throughout different Caribbean islands. One of those Caribbean islands is what later became Haiti. And he was so influenced by the development of the Haitian Revolution that his intention was to go back to Venezuela and start a revolt of slaves there, just as they were doing in Haiti. He organized slaves, led a revolt. They killed a bunch of Spanish colonizers. Eventually, the revolt was put down. Chirinos was captured, beheaded. They stuck his head on a stick and put it on the outskirts of the main road that led into the city so that everybody who came into the city could see, as they would say, what happens if you try to overthrow slavery. So I began trying to find out how much I could about Chirinos, but didn't find much written about him, certainly not in English. And like all well-trained researchers, when you can't find anything through the general literature, I decided to Google him. So the first thing I came across was an airport in Coro, Venezuela, named after Chirinos. So I'm thinking, nah, I know they didn't name an airport after this guy killed all these Spanish people and all of that. But I looked at it further, and actually, that's who it's named after. And the first thing that occurred to me that is, at that time, I couldn't think of a park bench that was named after Nat Turner. And the point being that there's a different way of how you see history. And one of the ways is that in Venezuela, slave revolts are looked at as part of the democratic struggle within all of the Venezuelan people, particularly against colonization. And in fact, slave revolts are looked at as the first struggles against colonization. So that slave revolts, the struggle of Afro-Venezuelans, are looked at as being in the center of Venezuelan history. The United States takes a much different point of view. And incidentally, a few years ago, Ross Baraka, who's the mayor of Newark, New Jersey, renamed the biggest public park in New Jersey the Nat Turner Park. So that when I was a kid in junior high school and in high school, you know, you had your textbook for an American history, and it always had some kind of title like The Journey Towards Liberty or The Road to Freedom and all of that. And you learned about the Boston Tea Party and all that kind of stuff. But never did they look at the struggle of African people for liberation from slavery as a part of that narrative of the struggle for freedom. And so that is what this New York Times project is trying to do, and I think they're turning the material of it into some kind of a book form or something, but it's something that should be read and spread widely. One of the issues it brings up is the struggle, the role of slavery in the development of capitalism and in the development of the economy of the United States. Now that's an old discussion that people still resist having, and actually one of the first comments on the role of slavery and development of capitalism came from Karl Marx in his first volume of Capital, and many of you have heard this, but he says, quote, "The discovery of gold and silver in America, the extirpation, enslavement, and entombment in mines of the aboriginal population, the beginning of the conquest and looting of the East Indies, the turning of Africa into a warren for the commercial hunting of black skins signalized the rosy dawn of the era of capitalist production." So already in the 1800s, you have a significant scholar who's looking at the role that slavery, the slave trade, the murder of and displacement of native peoples as being kind of the significant contributor. In the 1930s, there was a doctoral student in England named Eric Williams who was doing his dissertation, and he decided to take, kind of inspired by that quote from Karl Marx, he decided to take Karl Marx's idea and see if he could apply that to the development of capitalism in England. He wrote his dissertation. His dissertation was published in 1944, and it's called Capitalism and Slavery. And in that, he looks where the center of the slave trade was in Liverpool. And by going through all of their financial records and who was gaining through all of this, he drew a direct link between the development of the textile industry in England to the conduction of the slave trade and the profits from the slave trade. And about 40 years ago, there was a scholar in the United States who used to teach at Northwestern called Ron Bailey, who wrote his dissertation kind of doing what Eric Williams did, but relating it to the United States. And he looked at the mercantilists in New England and how they profited from the slave trade, turned that profits into textile mills, particularly in the Northeast, and that began kind of the development of what we see as the beginnings of capitalism in the United States. And he relates that saying it's not just a question of taking money from the slave trade, buying or beginning the textile industry, but as you begin the textile industry, you begin to draw people away from doing just self-dependent work into working in factories. Since they're working in factories, that then develops a market for other things those people need that they may have been producing for themselves. So that slave trade and began kind of the jump start of that. Anyway, when he wrote that, it was still an outlier in terms of how historians looked at slavery and capitalism, if they looked at it at all. But in the last 10 to 15 years, it's become beginning to dominate the center of historiography of slavery and capitalism. And there's a slew of books, one by Sven Beckert on, I think it's called Cotton and Empire, or The Empire of Cotton, or something like that. And they all began to look at the role that slavery played in the development of U.S. capitalism, and essentially all come to the point that slavery and its attendant racism are inextricably tied to the development of capitalism in the United States. And some of the things they look to prove, to show it, you know, there's still among a lot of historians and among some in the general public, that slavery had nothing to do with the Civil War. And you hear that, if you hear historians talking, you hear about that all the time. So I looked at the Mississippi Statement on Secession that was written in 1860. And I picked Mississippi because it's in Chicago. And I figured most African Americans are maybe one step or two steps removed from Mississippi. So I thought that might be a relevant state to look at. Anyway, the Mississippi Secession Statement said, "Our position is thoroughly identified with the institution of slavery, the greatest material interest of the world. Its labor supplies the product which constitutes by far the largest and most important portions of commerce of the earth. These products have overcome necessities of the world, have become necessities of the world, and a blow at slavery is a blow at commerce and civilization." And so just openly within their statement, they're not only defending their own plantations, they're defending Western capitalism, they're defending the world because they understand that's the foundation of it. In addition to it, and many of the historians say the best kind of analogy to look at the role that cotton played in the 1800s is to look at the role that oil plays now. I mean, it's the dominating factor that everybody wants control of. Just like people are fighting all of these wars over oil, that's how people felt about cotton in the 1800s. And some of the things they looked at is that the Mississippi Valley had more millionaires per capita than any place else in the United States in the 1860s. The value of slaves in the slave-owning states was larger than the value of all the railroads and the factories in the rest of the country put together. New Orleans had more banking capital than all of the banks in New York And of course, New Orleans was a major shipping point for cotton. And in 1810, there were 87,000 cotton spindles, things that you use in factories to spin cotton. In 1810, there were 87,000. By 1860, there were 5 million spindles. Not only that, but all of the structures that we think of as kind of normal in capitalism are structures that were created to serve the slave trade and slavery. All the business principles of accounting, the concept of business insurance, mortgages had nothing to do with houses. You were mortgaging slaves. That all of these things were modeled on slavery. One of the things that some of the arguments in the New York Times series say that it's not just the economics of slavery that dominated the economics of the United States, but it's also the violence of slavery bled over into the violence of capitalism as we live it now. So, for example, all this stuff about the Second Amendment, much of what people say, a lot of that is nonsense. If you were living in the United States in the 1780s when the Constitution was written, the last thing you were worried about is someone breaking into your barn or breaking into your house and stealing something for you, and therefore you needed a gun to defend yourself. It had nothing to do with that. What it did have to do with fear of slave revolts. And Southerners insisted on putting that in the Constitution because they needed to have an armed society to forestall any revolt among the slaves. The other thing is policing. The first policing that existed in the United States was started in the South in the 1720s, and what they were slave patrollers. I mean, that's what people looked at as police. And in that, you didn't have police in the modern sense in the North until almost the mid-1800s. And then they were only there to stop people from robbing stuff from the factory. So the bourgeoisie said, hey, look, we can hire or build a police department, put them on the public payroll, and they'll protect all of our stuff, essentially. But real policing started in slave patrols. And out of that came this sense that the life of an African American had no moral value whatsoever. And it's that kind of philosophy that was inculcated in the beginning of policing in the United States that exists in large part to this day. It's a continuation of the origins of how policing developed in the United States. In fact, I know for a fact in California, in Oakland, and in Los Angeles, as the African-American populations in those cities began to grow, the police departments actively went to the South to recruit police to come to Oakland and to come to Los Angeles. And you know, outside of maybe Chicago and New York, Oakland and Los Angeles have probably the most racist, violent police forces in the country. And the other thing that I thought about that actually Frank mentioned earlier, that if you look at the conditions in the African-American community specifically, but in working class community broadly, you see poor educational facilities, you see poor public health facilities, you see poor housing. But it can be difficult to strike a chord among people in the African-American community to come out and get them to demonstrate in large numbers against all of those things. But the spontaneity that often occurs with a police shooting is something that defies the process that we looked at when we're talking about housing and education. And without getting too idealistic, it's almost like there's something in the historical DNA of African Americans that when they see a police shooting like that, it harkens back to slavery and harkens back to slave patrollers and harkens back to the founding idea of policing in this country that African American lives have no matter. And that's why this concept of Black Lives Matter was an important thing, because it spoke, even if not consciously, it spoke directly to that problem. The other thing is, in the 1960s, the rebellions of the 1960s, after they were over, around 1967, 1968, President, I guess it was Johnson, commissioned a report to study it. It's called the Kerner Commission Report. And it came out, I was still in high school, but they put copies out in paperback. And I read it, and they sought to categorize every rebellion, urban rebellion, that happened in the United States from 1964 up to 1967. And I remember reading through that whole book, and if my memory serves me correctly, every single urban rebellion started at the beginning as a response to police violence. Whether it be 1964 in Harlem, it was a murder by Officer Gilligan, I remember his name, of a young African American. In South Central, or Watts, in Los Angeles, it was the beating of Marquette, I can't remember his last name. In 1967 in Detroit, it was the attack on people in the Hotel Algiers. They call it the Hotel Algiers incident. Every single, and those are just the top ones, but even small disturbances, because they literally went through every city in the country to catalog these things and investigate them. Every single disturbance in there was started by an act of police violence. And so I think some of the struggles that organizations like the Alliance are involved in, I think, hit at one of the centers of repression and the oppression of African American communities and other minority communities. And I think that the development of the Alliance into a national organization, given its history and its kind of seasoned and experienced activists, allows it to play a significant national role in raising some of these issues of police violence and police accountability. And I try to keep up with what they're doing in Chicago, largely through Frank's Facebook page, in which he has a lot of the goings on in terms of getting a CPAC adopted or bringing into law into Chicago. And I think that, again, the Alliance becoming a national organization puts it in a position to have things like CPAC become a model that organizations, movements in other cities can adopt and then adapt to whatever their particular situation is. The other thing is that, as when I started off saying that the intertwining of racism and capitalism, that they're so interconnected that it's literally impossible even to think of how you would unravel one without unraveling the other. Because they're so closely connected in terms of their historical development, in terms of their rationalizations. For example, if you just take the African-American community, but then if you include Latino community, Native American communities, think about what it would take to increase the educational facilities across the country in these communities, to provide these communities across the country with adequate public health systems, public health, housing, education, employment. If you can imagine how many trillions of dollars it would take. Literally, what you'd have to do is almost rebuild every city in the United States, embarking on something like a Marshall Plan that was done for Western Europe after World War II. In addition to that, you'd have to build the South, particularly for African Americans. A large percentage of African Americans still live in the South, and a significant percentage of them live in rural areas under poverty conditions that would be unimaginable to people even from Chicago and into New York. So where is that money going to come from to rebuild these communities, to try to redress the ills that capitalism has visited upon them for the last several hundred years? We can't even get the most we can get is one or two Democrats running for the presidency who talk about a 5% wealth tax. But a 5% tax on the most wealthy wouldn't even put a nick in the kind of reconstruction that would have to be done in order to renovate these communities. And in fact, what you need is not to tax their wealth by 5%, but what you need to do is expropriate their wealth and bring it back into the hands of the people, and then use that wealth that's been generated by working class people to build up society in the interests of all. I have one last thing I want to say, and that's about Trump, as you might, you know. And it's getting a little tiring. You know, you don't even watch the news anymore. It's like one asinine thing after another. But it's important that there be a broad-based alliance of organizations and people to make sure that Trump is not reelected in 2020. And though as we have as our goal the fundamental transformation of the social order in this country, that's just a pipe dream if we can't stop this guy, if we can't get this guy out of office. So I think this will be an interesting year. I'm looking forward to see the various organizations like the Alliance and others putting people in the struggle and building this kind of broad democratic movement that can start the first step of restructuring the society of this country by getting rid of Trump and eventually getting rid of all of the capitalists.